Hello, everybody, and welcome back to The Hopeless Romantic after a long absence. Amanda and I are back in the saddle and excited to be with you again. And we are also delighted to be joined today by Jin Hale, who is here to talk to us about historical fantasy and also her new book, The Long Past, which is coming out on a date I should have written down, but didn't.
Hi. Wait, let me look it up.
While we're looking up that date, Jin Hale is the author.
October 3rd.
Jin Hale is the author of the Cade Leonian series, Wicked Gentlemen, the Rifter serial, and many other things. And now, The Long Past, which is a Wild West fantasy historical novel, which is a combination of things that I love. Also dinosaurs as well, and is really cool. So welcome, Jin. Thank you for being here with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I figure I will jump in because I had the first exposure to Jin Hale back in like 2008. My friend had a copy of Wicked Gentlemen that she lent me.
Sounds like a disease. I've been exposed to Jin Hale. The rash is mostly cleared up, but sorry. Go on.
Every time I open up a Jin Hale manuscript, I break out in hives. They're good hives, though. They're pleasant hives.
Good, they're honey good hives. Good. Delicious, honey sweet hives.
But yeah, I read Wicked Gentlemen, the year after it came out? Ever since then, I've had a fond appreciation of you. And I was really excited when you said yes to appearing. And we will actually have Jin on at a later date for one of our other episodes that is in the works. So if you want to hear a little bit more detail on specifically what it takes to write series, tune in to that later. First, we wanted to ask you about specifically The Long Past, because that is coming out October 3rd.
Hey!
Thank you for reminding me. I'll write it down. Right, October 3rd, be online.
Post-it note on the monitor.
October 3rd, something scrawled there badly.
So, from the description already, there's a lot going on in this book, just sort of at the premise. There is dinosaurs, there's Wild West stuff, there are a lot of fantasy elements beyond just the dinosaurs. There's magic in this world. So where did this premise come from? The classic question, like, how did you come up with this? What was the impetus for writing this story?
Well, I had 103 degree fever. No, actually, I didn't. The premise was a kind of a combination. It began with an argument, actually, online.
And it was, as happens,
on Twitter, where I don't know if anyone follows a couple different artists. There's Medieval People of Color and a few other who, you know, highlight the fact that people of color have existed throughout history and should be recognized as part of history and integral to it. And there was this argument where someone was like trying to claim that there were no black cowboys and that, you know, the Wild West, first of all, the American West was somehow completely white, even though there were tons and tons of Native Americans there before anybody showed up. And then,
most cowboys were Mexican.
It was a very, very diverse population because it was, you know, this new opportunity, especially before statehood and, you know, in these transitory states. So I really want to make sure that the next story I write, if I ever do write a historical story, definitely touches on the fact that diversity isn't just queer characters, it's also people of color, it's people with different abilities, you know, and different disabilities. And so that was already going around in my head. And I was kind of messing around with the idea of writing a historical, like an alt history. But I was very, very nervous about it because alt history requires not just research, but it requires you to be dependent on other people's research. A lot of biographies and things like that. And those can be very, very slanted from the period they're written from. So it's really easy to be like, oh, this Empire of the Sun and Moon, this guy knows. But then you're like, this is a white guy writing about, you know, a Native American uprising. And, you know, at certain points, even though this is a Pulitzer Award winning book, there are parts of it that really, you know, you stop and you're like, should he really be thinking that these people were inherently less civilized or less or more brutal, just naturally more brutal? If only they'd learned to farm, they would have been better, more caring people. And I was like, whoa, whoa, okay. You already have very limited resources, especially for first-person experiences of people who are already marginalized. Being able to, like, take what I could find that was first-person, you know, some autobiographies and things like that, even though oftentimes historians will say things like, I get this a lot when I was looking into Nat Love, people are like, well, he just wildly romanticized his existence. But the thing that's really interesting about his biography, his autobiography, is that it's his actual take on how he would like to have been seen. It tells you so much more about his experience of being himself and his identity than maybe an actual history does. And you can look up dates and histories and things like that. But it was really interesting to get these voices of real people talking about their real experiences. And then by pulling in magic, being able to get this lens where I could shift the events to fit the voices of the real people of the time. And then at some point when doing all this research, I was like, what is it with the Victorians and dinosaurs? They're like everywhere. I mean, it was when I was looking through Charles Dickens' Bleak House, and I find this description of a dinosaur, like, and then the streets were so murky, one would not have been surprised to see a giant dinosaur coming at you. And I was like, what? And then I realized, of course, that, you know, 1841 is when the word dinosaur was termed, like, or coined. And so it's like this whole period, dinosaurs were a new thing. They're so exciting. And, you know, the Victorians are like, there could be dinosaurs anywhere. Venezuela could be full of dinosaurs, you know. And so
secret dinosaur.
You know, the Victorians are just looking for dinosaurs. Give it to them.
Yeah.
And you know, I already had magic introduced. So I was like, hey, there's this magic battle going on during the Opium War. And they pull up these big rifts in time and bam, they get the Cretaceous era.
I like the idea that just every Victorian person was the kid who was obsessed with dinosaurs in like grade school, which is me.
Right. Yeah. It would be weird, though, like if you were going along and just, you know, you have this idea of civilization and it begins with the Bible and, you know, or whatever your idea was of your history. And then there's this massive shift in it. And you're like, oh, actually, there were millions of these giant animals running around.
Yeah.
And they bear little resemblance to the animals of today.
Right. These are completely different.
I wonder how many people were conspiracy theorists who were like, no, they faked these dinosaurs. They're all plastic. Well, there are still people today who think that, so.
Right. Them being plastic to the Victorians would have been awesome. They're like, wow, oh, yeah, what is this?
Incredible.
By Jove, what's this amazing material? Yeah, so that's kind of how The Long Past came about. I just really wanted to explore, you know, pretty intimate stories, actually. Just like two or three characters having these adventures and really, you know, upbeat, exciting stories that sort of celebrate diverse characters and let them go ahead and be, you know, magical and have adventures and not just confine them to stories that are all centered on their oppression, not to define us by our hardship, but rather that's a challenge that we overcome and then we triumph. And those are the stories that I really, really want to share.
Yeah, that's something that I should note about the book. The Long Past centers around a longer novella that kind of deals with how this world came to be. I don't want to get into spoiler territory because there's lots of twists and turns in it. But it deals with, you know, the making of this world. It's still quite intimate and centered around a few characters. And then there are also other short stories set in this world. One of which, Amanda actually edited for Magic and Mayhem.
Oh yeah, for Magic and Mayhem, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which was really fun. I enjoyed going and rereading it because I haven't read it since I first read the paperback of Magic and Mayhem last year, almost exactly a year ago. So that was fun to revisit, especially having the other stories to place it in a larger verse. Because I remember, I think Nicole Kimberling was like, alt history world with dinosaurs and magic. And I was like, that sounds awesome.
That doesn't sound weird at all. Well, the interesting thing about that was that it came about because there was that call. You remember that challenge? Austin, you wrote a great story also for that anthology.
Oh, yeah.
It was for the cyborgs mage. And... Mages and Cyborgs. Yeah. And I was already writing The Long Past, the novella. I you know, was almost done with it at that point that, you know, I was at GRNW or it's Read with Pride now. And there was this call and I was like, well, that's really interesting. Well, I probably couldn't do that. And then like 2 minutes later, of course, I was like, wait, yes, I could. And I could put in dinosaurs. Yes, it's in the same world. This is fabulous.
See, I love that we wound up with not one, but two magical Westerns just from the from the prompt Mage Cyborg. Like,
right. That's where your mind goes immediately, is it has to be in the Old West.
That's where my mind goes with most things, though. Yeah, I do love, I'm actually taking a history class on women in the American West, which is really fun. It's been interesting looking at a lot of source material that usually gets overlooked in the traditional Western narrative. Like, they just had us rewatch episode one of Ken Burns' The West, which is well-intentioned but wrong.
And, right. I saw that. Yeah. It's...
It's like really well made, and it's unfortunately, you know, sort of the seminal Western documentary, and it's, you know, some things in it are better than they could be, but generally speaking, it's still a colonialist fantasy. That's one of the things that I'm always fascinated with, because I was just thinking about this because I was reading some K.J. Charles. Oh my God, I did it again. I referenced K.J. Charles on our goddamn podcast.
You gotta get that K.J. Charles reference in there.
Always drinking games, gotta continue. But I was reading some alt like British history and sort of fantastical interpretations of British history, and I was like, to me, the only version of that I strongly identify with is alt Western stuff, because I'm a West Coaster. I always have been, so East Coast stuff is a little bit more intangible to me. And unfortunately, a lot of traditional Western fiction is off limits to me, because I find it just too much of that, like, myth, the very white, male-dominated cowboys and Indians thing. So anytime that I can find retellings of Western stuff that are, you know, spec fic or queer or all of the above, I'm always excited, and I have plenty of my own little ideas for that I eventually will have to write someday before I'm dead.
Well, I would encourage you, the more variety out there, the quicker these ideas will get dismantled, I think. And actually, in the process of researching these stories, I started to really want to change the narrative myself. And so I was like, oh, you know, there's this colonialism going on. And in the first story, it just kind of touches on it with the Opium War, the outcome changing a little. But by the third story, the entire of the Raj has been subverted. A lot of colonialism in Africa has been subverted. And I just really wanted to show this kind of idea that the history we have is just a history of coincidences. It isn't something that's done because one group is inherently better. It's just by chance certain things changed and the history worked out the way it is now, but there was no reason it couldn't have been different.
And I think that's really important. It's important to fight that narrative of inevitability, because that's right. What allows so much, even modern day oppression, to exist as if it's part of some perfect narrative. I mean, white people have been obsessed for a long time with the idea that there is a narrative attached to their successes in the world that is just like the narrative of the universe.
Right. And also it's allowed them to erase their failures. Yeah, let's just not talk about South Africa anymore. You know, all of a sudden it just disappears as soon as, you know, someone's like, no, get the out of here, you know, or India just drops off the radar in the 60s suddenly. You know what I mean? Like, anytime there are these narratives that just really challenge their ideas, they don't get told. Like, there were entire Black communities in the West that were perfectly functioning, wonderful cities that existed for a really long time until active white oppression wiped them out. So, and those are stories that oftentimes don't get told because first of all, they are and should be shameful. But second of all, they don't follow that narrative that it's just some, you know, innate whiteness that allows you to succeed, not like it's innate whiteness plus a huge amount of oppression and weapons and funding, and it's aggressive. I don't know, that bothers me. I hope it bothers other people too. Yeah,
certainly anyway. Should. On that topic, I did want to ask what some of your research and writing methods were for this book. And also, did you work with sensitivity readers? What was your process like for that?
I did have what people call, I really don't like the term sensitivity readers. It makes it sound like you have an allergy.
I don't love it either.
I understand you want authentic voices, and you want people who have a closer experience to these characters that you're trying to write to give you feedback. You know, I think that's really, really integral to a lot of times capturing authentic voices, and to also just not making missteps, you know, not writing something that seems normal to you, but is not at all another person's experience and is in direct opposition to what they know to be true of themselves. So that's really important. And I did do that. And I did a lot of research, a huge amount of reading. I don't even know if I could list all of the books. You know, things from like 19th century black leaders. It's just a huge book that just gives like biographies and information all the way to, you know, murder in Victoria, in Victorian England, and the understanding of it. So it was a huge amount of nonfiction reading. I sought out as many autobiographies as I could, and I just tried to get overall a feel for the era. But after that, I also really, really tried not to let what was put down in history books dictate the outcomes of my stories. You know, like, I really loved real details, but I didn't want to be like, oh, you know, this is a fact, therefore this inevitably happens.
It's really easy once you do that amount of research and you feel like you've soaked yourself in the facts, so to speak, that you have to follow those to the letter, or you find one particular detail really interesting, so you put it in, and it ends up contradicting the rest of your story.
Well,
like,
yeah,
it's
sure.
Really tempting to show that research on the page, especially if you find some of it particularly interesting. And in fact, that is probably the opposite of what should happen. Sort of subconscious foundation, not necessarily show up on the page. Or at least that's my opinion of it, unless you're actually writing something that is like a historical nonfiction book.
It kind of defeats the purpose of having it be like a fantasy fiction if you're just like, no, I'm not going to subvert anything. Everything's going to happen exactly the same.
It's the same, but there's dinosaurs. Literally, right, somehow, that's the only difference.
Literally, dinosaurs don't change history at all. Much less, you know, like magic, people with magic and airships, but somehow they still can't seem to change history even a little bit.
So. Everything went as planned.
Somehow they knew it was planned too, like they'd read a history book already.
With that said, I feel like you ground it in a lot of historical realities that are important. I was going to point out that you're... The long past is pretty blunt with historical realities of sexism and racism, and how those impacted people and what that meant. And I think that sort of grounding of not washing away what was present and virulent in society at that time,
right? Yeah,
is really important as well.
Well, yeah, it's one of those difficulties of this fine line where you don't want to tell. First of all, you don't want to whitewash it. You don't want to be like, and everybody loved everyone, you know? Like, and somehow, for reasons that no one could figure out, everyone who was black just had a hard time. Don't know why. Everyone who was queer just kept it to themselves because they were polite like that, you know?
it was just a different time,
you know? I've encountered stories like that, too, where I get a little angry. And you know, I kind of question myself. I'm like, why am I getting angry at this positive representation? And I'm like, because it's a lie. And because it makes the characters who are queer, if you remove any mention of their oppression, then you actually are taking away a lot of what real people experience. And a part that to some degree defines all of our experiences are the hardships we overcome. They aren't who we are, but they do shape our experience. And so I really felt that that was important to acknowledge. But at the same time, I really did not want to put together a story or a series of stories that simply were a rehash of tales of oppression. You know what I mean? I genuinely believe that marginalized people can and will triumph, that we will have equality in human rights, and we are going to win. no matter what fight it is, we will win eventually. We've come really far. So just in my lifetime, and I'm only 50.
Only 50.
You're a baby.
But, you know, there's so much to be hopeful about that even in really terrible times, like politically right now, it is not a great time. However, we know that we can win. And that makes such a difference. Having hope is so important. And so I really did not want to write a story where in the end it's like, we tried really hard and I guess we just weren't good enough. Oh, yeah. Well, that is not a story anyone needs to hear, especially not if you really are trying hard right now and you just want to take a break and read, you know, something exciting and fun. There's no reason to have like a downer ending in every single book that ever discusses any marginalized identity.
Especially something based on somewhat in actual history. So it feels like if you're going to change things, why wouldn't you change things for the better? It's like, why would you make an alternate history and make things worse?
Right. Well, I asked that question to myself and I said, oh, you wouldn't. Hey, Jen, why not write a really terrible story? I don't know, Jen. Maybe because that's a terrible idea. Yeah, let's not do that.
See, it's funny, too, because I balance so much of what I want in fiction is escapism versus reality. And I have a much easier time seeing those like oppressionless or better versions of oppression, if there is such a thing, in fantasy that isn't contemporary or based on our history. Like I have a much easier time if it's like not Earth.
Right. I mean, that's because from a writing point of view, you have an obligation if you are writing about people who really exist. You have an obligation to acknowledge the trials they have and the hardships. So that's why I think if it's an alt, even an alt history, you can't just whitewash it. You can't be like, and there were no problems except dinosaurs. That was the only problem, 100%.
And scurvy.
We all came together to deal with the dinosaur situation.
Right.
And then everything was fine.
And everything was A-okay. No, but whereas a fantasy setting, since oftentimes you aren't directly dealing with real people, in the sense of people who, in our historic context, have real history. You know, you're just dealing with, you know, kind of worlds you make up, and you can make them as utopian as you want, or you can, you know, put in problems and kind of isolate them to specifically discuss a social problem or, you know, whatever it is you want to discuss. It's more acceptable for it to be a little bit more isolated and maybe a little less nuanced. And partly because, you know, you're explaining so much more in a fantasy world to begin with, that if you start nuancing the conflicts a lot, that's a lot of exposition for your readers. just from a technical point of view.
You do need to consolidate some things, which is why, and it's also why places like fantasy and science fiction have been great places to explore allegory and challenge existing systems of oppression in a removed way. Like I remember reading a lot of science fiction that actually at the time challenged my notions of racism or whatever internalized bullshit I had going on. And it was because I was reading something extrapolated to a different context without all of the trappings involved in my daily life. I really like that part of fantasy and sci-fi. And I think that it's important that we keep that up, even if all we want to do is write a romp with a utopia and maybe some dragons.
Right, right.
You can do both the utopia and the dragons and the extrapolated, morality tales. I don't know.
Speaking of that, I wanted to talk about the challenges of world building for two things at once, because when you're writing something that's, you know, deeply historically researched, you're kind of introducing the reader into a world that they're not familiar with a lot of times, unless they read very widely in that genre. And even then, given how many misconceptions there are in the Western genre, you might be dealing with sort of rewriting or overwriting their preconceived notions. But then you're also world building a magic system, a dinosaur
and also,
system.
As many people as there are who are really into historical, like the facts they know in history, there are the same number who are into that about dinosaurs.
Yes.
The book isn't even released yet, but I already have people who are like, so warm-bloodedness, we need to talk about this with dinosaurs. I'm like, no, God, no. It's amazing the number of people who are very, very passionate about their dinosaurs. Anyway, but I know what you're talking about, like how to sort of compress historical information, magical systems, and then also, you know, introducing an entirely new species into a world. You know, it's gigantic amounts of world building. And as far as like my personal way of doing it is to try to make it to integrate them into each other. You know, so the characters are wearing dinosaur leather and, you know, the food they have is pemmican when they're traveling, which, you know, is a historical food, though I also had to eat it as a kid. So,
yeah, it's unpleasant.
God,
it's unpleasant.
Pemmican nightmares. You know, they have dinosaur pemmican and things like that. Trying to integrate all of it into the actual action seems to help not bog readers down in just pure information. Mm-hmm. However, I know that there are other writers who just prefer to have, you know, a paragraph at the beginning of whatever that explains the setting. Like I'm thinking of, I think it's Rivers of Teeth. That's the one that's, it's also like an alt history, but it's with a bunch of hippopotamuses.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I believe that is correct.
Yeah, and it's...
I'm Googling this. I just want to make sure that it... Yep, it is. Yep, it's the alt history hippo western.
Yeah, River.
That's amazing.
What? Sarah Gailey.
Yeah,
it's really good. It's real good. It came out in May of this year.
Okay.
I'll link it in the show notes. It's real good.
But anyway, yes.
Yeah, and it also features a number of queer characters and queer identities. And it's quite a good book, but her way of introducing her world was simply to just straight up put in an explanation at the beginning that is almost like an authorial note. Simply to say, here's what's going on, here's what you're in. You know?
Yeah.
And just drop you in. But you have like this whole, here's how my world runs. And so I don't think there's just one way to do it. It's just kind of what feels natural to an author.
Yeah, I mean, you can, I think that's a valid choice to just be like, hey, just so I don't have to deal with this and we're all on the same page, here's what's going on. I was going to say, I also like the way you did it in the long past of having the world building follow the flow of the story. And it's just like where you would naturally encounter a historical detail or a magical detail, it's there.
Yeah, and I mean, it also helps that I believe the maps are at the beginning, which does...
Oh, yeah.
It's a really great visual way to tell people a little bit of what's going on. It's like, okay, I mean, you probably read the blurb. Maybe you know some things about this book, but specifically, this is what the landscape looks like. So shake whatever preconceived notions you have in your head out.
Right. When you're dealing with gigantic floods, which actually are, you know, actually very small compared to what the Cretaceous North America looked like. But, you know, I had to pull it back a little bit to leave some society. It's like, and
you're like,
no, everyone's dead.
Has to survive.
Right.
Three people.
Yeah, three lonely, sad people who are separated by gigantic mountains and waves. Like, hey!
This is an inspiring romp about three stranded, miserable people.
One and of whom dinosaurs. Hey! Don't give away the ending.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. Dysentery. Oh, yeah.
Poor Lawrence.
Yeah, no, I
we
avoided that
him.
As much as possible.
I like the idea of, I mean, you see a lot of maps and historical stuff anyway, like, hey, this is who controlled what at the time, and this was, you know, the major cities, and I enjoy those, but there also is something about fantasy maps where you're just like, aha, I know what I'm in for, and I rarely,
right.
I can't tell you the amount of times I haven't gone back and looked at the geography of a, you know, a fantasy world, like, I just don't usually go back and double check. It's like, oh, okay, there's like an island here, and these are presumably two places they're at war, and you just keep reading, and, you know, usually the narrative will fill in the gaps, and it doesn't matter if you go back and look at it. But for this, I flipped back to the beginning to, like, really get a sense of what had flooded.
Wait, did she just take away all of Florida? Like, sorry, yeah. Florida! Nothing personal!
Bye, Florida.
You were always underwater. Yeah.
R.I.P.
Yeah, I feel like
you are now all...
It's personal, especially if you're an American reading this book. You're kind of, you have that visceral sense of like, oh, you put that place that I know underwater.
And it's like, oh, you put my favorite city underwater. Thanks.
I know. I actually had a number of like people who were reading it and they were like, why did you flood my town? And I'm like, it wasn't personal. I swear it wasn't personal. I just went by the elevations and the amount of water involved. You know, I mean, it was actually one of those things where I figured out that, you know, and I'm doing the thing and I'm checking the maps and I'm like, oh, I've wiped out England. I mean, it's like one mountaintop is left of England.
Sorry, England.
And to some extent, I started, you know, just for the sake of the story, pulling the water levels back at that point, you know, where I could. I'm like, okay, I need to back on this, even though, according to my own description, it would be way, way worse, you know?
I definitely went and revisited those maps. Was it one map, two maps? I don't remember.
Two maps. I think there are actually three maps. Hang on. I know,
I'm opening my
Kindle.
You'd
think I'd have a copy of my own book, and I think
I do. Why would
you
have that?
Oh, yeah. Because you've got the 1864 map of the United States and the 1896.
And mm-hmm. the 1858.
The final map, I think it's 1896 one, is the one where I was like, yes, this map really needs to be there because it was important to me just to show how the world altered. And then there's, I think, a world map,
yeah,
which is a little harder for people to probably see how different things are.
Well, you're kind of like, oh yeah, that's the shape of the continents. And then you're like,
one of those where that was also one where it was like, can we put a little more back in, you know, when it was first drawn for me. And I was just like, okay, is there any way to put some land masses back in? And the artist is like, well, you said this elevation. And I'm like, yeah, but I lied.
Now I really miss all of the Midwest. Oh, well, I miss Texas. Like,
sorry, Texas. That's where you are now. Don't worry. You're going to be fine.
You'll drain.
I do enjoy how much of the West Coast survived, though. That made me happy.
Okay, West Coast, West Coast.
Yeah.
Smug, high-elevation West Coasters.
That's right.
Yeah. You can take the girl out of the California, but you can't take the California out of the girl. That sounds like I'm fucking California.
Are you
it
not?
Does seem like there should be an ad that breaks in now that's like, California tourism.
Go to Disneyland. Actually, I'm looking at the map again, sort of. Morning. just sort of
oh,
mourning
no.
various locations. Hold on. Yeah, so San Francisco City.
San Francisco kind of, San Francisco actually ended up moving a little bit because.
Yeah, I was looking and I was like, that looks a little bit more inland.
Because of the time period that the floods occur, it moves inland a bit. So there are cities that still have the same names because they existed, but they would have moved.
They would have moved, yeah. Where roughly do you know where San Francisco City ended up being? Because this looks almost, trying to think. I kind of want to overlay map of California over this and figure it out.
I remember there was a lot of looking into spots where it could go in the area where sea level rises for global warming predicted that San Francisco would be completely wiped out and areas that would be, you know, which basically shaved off most of the California coast. And so it was one of the little kind of inland areas that would create a bay were all of San Francisco to be flooded. Yeah, it changes, just these coastlines just change as soon as you have water levels rising by very much at all. And then if you have an entire ocean, double your ocean.
Well, good job, Chicago. You made it.
Chicago made it only by the skin of its teeth and by... It technically, Chicago should not have made it, but I had too many people in Chicago telling me.
I mean, Chicago, that sort of upper... That area... Yep, geography. You would have, I think, lost quite a bit more up there, and then it would be hard to travel.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also much more flooding and major freshwater lakes would have disappeared, which would have meant that potable water would become a serious problem. And so, and since I didn't want to have to deal with having them introduce desalination in the 1800s,
that's a problem.
I just went ahead and, yeah.
Oof, yeah.
Spare yeah, Chicago.
You stumble on those problems. It's like, well, okay, I would flood out the freshwater lakes. Oh, wait, it's the 1800s. That means they're pretty screwed. Well, okay, I guess I won't flood out the lakes, which means that this is still available. And that means that, like, by keeping Chicago, you change the direction of transit and stuff like that. I don't know. It's really interesting to see, like, one change tweaks the entire system.
Right, yeah. And then at some point, while you're doing this, you have to be like, I'm not making up a world for people to play video games in. I just want to write one short story.
You're like, this is literally just for my own entertainment and edification, and yet...
Well originally it was, because I wasn't even writing it to publish. I was writing it just... A lot of times this happens. I just really want to create the story. And so The Long Past wasn't actually being written for any publication. I was just writing it for myself. And so I was doing huge amounts of research, and, you know, my editor would be calling me about the other stories that were due at the time, which was the second of The Champion of the Scarlet Wolf.
Oh,
and
wow.
She'd be like, so how are you doing on that? And I'd be like, really close. Just need to read a little bit more about Frederick Douglass. Like, you need to do what? Nothing. I'm not cheating.
I haven't written anything about a dinosaur today or yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, I did. I mean, if you don't count writing it on my arm, remember dinosaurs. Dinosaurs forever. You know, originally, none of this was really written, like, with the idea that, like, this is going to go to this market or to these people. I just wrote it because it was a story I really wanted to tell. You know, just to get out and to write and to, you know, be like, yes, I did it, you know. And so it wasn't until the call for another story came up with that anthology for GRNW that I was like, oh, you know, I could set another story in that setting that I've already made up and done all that research on. And then I was like, oh, because I got invited to take part in a Wild West, Weird West kind of anthology. And I was like, oh, I could put another story in that setting. And then I was like, oh, I have this whole, like, world now.
It's so exciting to set things in worlds you've already world built for. I'm discovering it's one of my favorite things. I'm like, oh my God, you mean I don't have to do all of this work again every time?
Once I do the hard world building, it's so much fun to play around in. It's like, oh yeah, I've done all of the hard work and now it's just fun.
Right. It only becomes a problem when you start doing, like, book 6 or something in a series.
Yeah.
And then you have to go back and, like, remember, like, what that one thing you wrote about that one kind of fork they use. You're like, oh, damn
me. You need your own Wikipedia. Just like... They actually have a tool for that, for writers to create their own sort of Wikipedia-esque thing. I forget which website it is. I should look it up. But I've considered using it for fantasy world building, just because when you're in the middle of writing, what did I call the fork?
Right,
where
right.
Did I put that? What notebook is it in? And it's like, no, just go look at your personal Wikipedia.
I just have a bunch of napkins. Most of my research is actually
too.
Written on, like, envelopes and napkins. Like, I write all these notes down because, as I've pointed out before, I'm not very technologically, you know, resourceful, so I'm pretty much like at one point I had an outline for a story written on my forearm.
Anytime I have to write down notes by hand, I'm like, I'm gonna lose these and they aren't as good as it would have been had I been able to type it, which is not necessarily the case, but it's certainly what my brain believes.
Yeah.
So I've got a various, like, all of my outlines and documents are all usually in, like, Google Docs or something, and they're not well organized.
My problem with my notes is that they come out exactly the way I would say them if I were describing them to a friend. So then I have to trawl through these pages of me being like, and, like, you know, it's kind of sort of a thing where they go here and, like, stuff happens and stuff. And it's just this, like, rambling Valley Girl ensemble. And I'm like, why did you do it this way? Why couldn't you just write down bullet points? Like, these things are in the scene.
See, I get the bullet points. Actually, I think I've shown you my outlines. They're usually me screaming.
Mm-hmm.
it's really easy for me to get bogged down in the research stages and just be like, wait, I'm not finished. I need to go back and double check this or triple check this, or I haven't finished developing this one arm of the world building. It's like, I haven't figured out their currency system. And it's just like, just make it up. It doesn't matter. Just be like, two silvers and you're done.
15 chickens. What? It's easy. Just carry some chickens around with you.
You just say you have vouchers for chickens. Chicken vouchers. That's their system of currency. It's all poultry. Jen and I were talking pre-recording about on her Wikipedia, when I was doing my like last minute, like final research to make sure there wasn't anything. Like, I usually do a lot, put it in the document, and then I'll go back like the day of to see if anything strikes me. And her Wikipedia is like, she grew up in an off the grid cabin for some of her childhood. And I was like, does that inform? Does that inform the way that you do things now? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It really does a lot. It's hard to sum up exactly the extent to which living for the first 8.5 to 9 years of my life with no technology, and I should add also almost no awareness that there was technology, really alters my experience, you know, like as an adult of looking at things. Everything is very, technology is much more exotic to me, I think, than it is to a lot of other people. Like, as I said earlier, I'm fascinated with toilets, flushing toilets. I cannot emphasize how amazing they are. Like, if all your life you've had to, like, dig pit latrines and actually turn your toilet, like, turn the soil to, like, create soil for gardens, it's just so amazing to be like, and then I
push
flush
a button. And I don't have to worry
done?
About it.
Oh my! Oh, I love technology 100%. Like the first time my mom brought my brother and I down from the mountains to a hotel, we lost our minds. I'm just gonna say, because we had never encountered really running water, electricity, flushing toilets, and so we were two little kids, and my brother is 2 years younger than me, so he was about six. Just running around this hotel room, flipping lights on and off, turning on all the taps, flushing the toilet over and over, and just doing it, like bouncing off the walls doing this. Like, it was mind-blowing. It was like being abducted by aliens and being like, this is an amazing new world. And it was like, to find out that it was everywhere was so
it was
hard.
Ubiquitous.
It's hard to describe. It's like, oh my god, you mean this has been going on all this time? All this time there have
no
been
one told
grocery
me.
Stores.
I don't have to cook on a wood stove.
A fire.
On a fire.
I feel like that must be a great perspective for informing researching historical details, though, taking less of that stuff for granted and looking more at the difference it makes.
Yeah, it was particularly when I wrote The Rifter, it was super easy to describe the character basically having my reverse journey, you know, where he's like going from having isotoner gloves to nothing. He's like, wait, everyone's really poor and dirty.
Just like, I want to hose them down.
This is a lot of hard work.
They literally don't do anything but work.
But work pretty much all the time. It does inform a great deal of it, though oftentimes I have to take out the stuff I know, because no one wants to read about the exciting adventure of digging a hole all day long. That usually I have to have that cut out. My editors a lot of times will be like, yeah, no one cares this much about how to get eggs from a chicken. Nobody cares. Just have them get the eggs. I'm like, but it's so hard.
Like, I
chickens
do
don't
so
want to give up their eggs.
To not put an homage in my book and be recognized for
right.
basically being a chicken hypnotizer. Because mm-hmm. it is very hard to get chicken eggs.
Yeah, it depends on the chicken. Every now and then there's a wily one.
Yeah, they're usually like all fine, and then there's the one where you're like, I might bleed today, we'll find out.
Yeah.
Chickens are dangerous.
Well, I had two favorite chickens, I have to admit. There was a hen that I really loved whose name was Anthrax, which at the time I didn't know that was a disease. I was just like, I love Anthrax. Years later, I'd be like, my parents were such dicks.
Your parents sound, I mean, they sound awesome if, like, they are characters in a book. Like, they sound extraordinary.
Well, my father has passed away, but my mom is still around, and she is amazing, I have to say. But every now and then, I'm just like, wait a minute, that was a lie. Like, like, she, for the longest time, when we first came back, you know, I had no idea about real civilization or anything, and so, you know, I'd find out, I'd go to, like, school, which was brand new and weird, and I found out you couldn't just leave, which was weird. Like, first day of school, I go, and I'm like, thanks for all this information. I'm just about full up, though. I'm going to head out. And they're like, oh, no, you don't get to do that. And I was like,
you're here
what?
All day.
What are you talking about? I got to go dig a hole.
It's hole digging time.
Those holes don't just dig themselves. But so I encountered, like, religion for the first time, which was so bizarre. Like,
oh, that must have been, yeah, oof.
If you've never ever encountered religion, it's strange, and especially when put beside mythology, because there's these fantastical stories, but for some reason that seems really arbitrary, people really believe one of them and not the other.
And boy, will they get mad if you mess those up.
They don't just get mad, they get furious. I spent a lot of time in the principal's office, let me tell you.
Accidental rebel, Jen Hale.
Yeah, well, kind of. And then on top of that, my mom would kind of prank me sometimes. So there was this one point where she was like, oh yeah, about Easter. So it's when, you know, Jesus, and she'd kind of told me what Jesus was, right? And I'm kind of like, okay, I got it. He's the dead zombie guy. And she's like, yeah, that's Jesus. Anyway, he comes back up from being dead. And if he sees his shadow, he goes back in, and there's like 3 more weeks of winter. And I was like, okay, I got it. All right, it makes sense to me. And I believed that until, I don't know, I was in like high school. And suddenly I'm like, wait a minute.
I feel like that was not a solitary prank. I feel like there may still be really esoteric things that your mother has told you.
Oh, there are.
You hold as true. And then one day you'll be like, God damn it.
Oh, I've continued to discover them throughout my life.
It's great. It's like a little Easter egg hunt, no pun intended. That's what's really fascinating in, like, I grew up fairly a-religious and was sort of baffled by the idea of at least organized religion. And I grew up in areas that were pretty religious, so I was pretty much constantly interrogated about what church I went to and what I believed. And so I just made shit up. And don't
well, there
do
you go. I follow the Church of Amanda. We pretty much worship Amanda and her rulings.
You say that, but when I was 10, I decided that I was my own religion. And I tried. I was like, I guess there has to be ritual in religion. So I'm going to put on a scarf and light incense and pray to myself. And I lasted a day. I was like, this is really boring.
You're like, this is a terrible religion. I'm leaving it. And then you're saying to yourself, you are outcast.
She's not nearly as cool.
Excommunicated.
Right. I've left the church. And that's one of the things that is a huge weakness of mine in terms of world building is that developing systems of faith and organized religion is hard for me because I have almost no personal sense of it and have only seen like the fringes of how churches work. So anytime I have to develop systems of religion, I have to do a lot of research. And it feels, it's really frustrating too, because it feels like I'm just outside of something that I should understand and I don't want to be disrespectful, mm-hmm. but I also mm-hmm. don't want to, I don't know. It's a weird line to walk, and it's only this, as far as I know, this is the only thing that I feel is fairly mainstream that I'm outside of. Like, obviously, I can only do my best to guess as to other people's lived experiences, like people with different disabilities or people of a different color or whatever. Like, I'm more resigned to not understanding. Like, okay, this one I feel like I shouldn't get. But just having grown up just outside of a glass door, and on the other side of which is, you know, religion is very strange. And I don't know, something about your exploits as a child reminds me of that like very pure like sense of like, I don't understand this thing, but I think you're supposed to say this. Like,
mm-hmm. Right.
Like,
right.
Do you go to church? Yes. I go on Thursdays to my church. It's down the street from my house. That's what happens, right? No. Who goes to church on Thursdays? What religion are you? Unitarian? I don't know.
Yeah, I have to do some research on religions if I'm doing any kind of fantasy writing, though it's easier, I think, in fantasy writing because the magic is real. So it's not exactly the same when you're writing a fantasy world with a religion if you have magic. And if you're writing, you know, a historical setting, or like if you're doing just a straight up contemporary story where you deal with religion, where it's a matter of faith and not necessarily any genuine fact. You know, it has more to do with community and identity and how people bond together and, you know, just that faith idea, as opposed to in a fantasy world where it's really very different if it's true, you know?
And like demonstrably on the ground. The god's right here. He's talking to me.
Right. If you have a person who is a god in your world, you know, and you have people worshiping that god, they're worshiping a specific person with real traits and things like that you can, you know, build your religion around, as opposed to, you know, when you're just kind of encountering religions in the real world and, you know, you're just sort of trying to muddle through figuring out, you know, what purpose it serves for people. That's very different.
And you've really only got, like, historical artifacts and accounts, whereas if something is living and breathing in your day, you're like, aha, I understand this. It's immediate. Whereas if you're trying to look at something that's thousands of years old, it's a little less easy to...
I was actually just thinking
well, sure,
about that.
And also, if it's just something you don't experience, like, if you aren't religious and weren't brought up in a religious environment, it's very hard to figure out what other people are experiencing in it. So it's one of those things where I know it's very significant and I know it's incredibly important to some people. Like it really is a key to a lot of their beliefs and their values. And whether those are good or bad, you know, I wouldn't condemn it at all, but it is something that does take a certain amount of research for me. It's sort of like doing fantasy research for me because it's an entirely different mindset.
Yeah. And one of the things about it that is, for me, difficult is I get hung up on ritual and, like, the symbols of religion. I tend to get hung up on the stuff that is concrete, like, oh, I understand that at such age you are baptized. Or I understand that, you know, this is how church services in this religion tend to go or what temple looks like. That stuff is what I tend to focus on, and that tends to, at least in my first drafts, make it into my writing. Like, and then they went and they did the ritual, or and then it's so much less focused on the internal life and the community and the social structures that faith and religion brings to people. And that is just, it's hard to wrap your head around if you haven't lived it.
I just usually rely on my wife. I'm like, so, church. Tell me a little bit about that.
Tell me about the church, yeah. Luckily, I know some people who grew up in religion or are still religious, and I've gone to services and, like, experienced sort of vicariously some of that community. So I get it a little bit more now, but it still feels like you said, sort of like I'm fantasy world building. It's just like I'm doing my best to understand something foreign to me.
Yeah, I was thinking about that the other day because I was a story that I've been kind of picking at and trying to world build for. I realized that I was inspired to have this mythological system, but there was an aspect of it that I'd really wanted that I was missing, which was that sense of reckoning with your own notion of God, whether or not that was true. The idea of not knowing whether there was a force behind these things that were happening, but believing something regardless. And that by making it a fantasy world, I had kind of lost the ability to reckon with that because it was so literal. Like, yeah, I mean, one of the gods probably did make that storm. And you know which
one. Right, yeah.
And also,
someone really is out to get you.
You've met them and they're kind of an asshole. So you probably know who did it. Versus, I really wanted, I wanted the sense of a character feeling like they were being punished or like something divine was against them. But having that also be an internal sense rather than an external sense that could be confirmed by the presence of a god who was like, yeah, fuck you. Fuck
you
this mortal
it to
in
be
particular.
Less tangible.
Yeah.
Yeah. He didn't want it to be someone being like, yeah, you offended me, all right. That's right.
I sure am pissed.
I'm really mad that you didn't like sacrifice that chicken to me. And you're like, but the chicken is so hard to catch.
We keep coming back to chickens, and I'm starting to think that we have a chicken thing.
Yeah.
I did have two pet chickens, so I was very attached to them.
Other I mean, I
people,
do enjoy
you know,
chicken.
Have various pets, but I had particularly one rooster who was like my super favorite. So I mention him now and then.
We had chickens when I was little, and I enjoy many things about chickens, but not the noises they make at weird times.
I had ducks, and they were horrible.
Oh God! Oh no!
They menaced
no.
my cat.
Ducks are terrible.
They made my cat so
ducks
scared.
Ducks are shockingly menacing. I know that people talk about like geese as being just terrorizing monsters, but don't underestimate ducks, especially
no.
groups.
I had Rowans too, which are like giant mallards, so they were bigger than my cat,
ooh.
And they scared her so bad. Anyway.
I'm so sorry for your
That's
cat.
My story.
I'm sorry for you. Those
That's my tale.
Ducks. chickens are good. They're just kind of wily and stupid and loud. They're weird creatures. Every time I look at them, I'm like, you don't seem like you should exist. Like, you seem like a joke. What's your face?
It's a dinosaur. You realize that,
dinosaur.
Right? You're a dinosaur.
Tying it all back yeah. to the long past.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Riding
That's it.
Chickens.
That's my... Doing the slow con here.
The slow burn.
I lure them in with the chickens and sell them on the dinosaurs.
Well, before we get too deep into chicken hell, Amanda, I know you had stuff you wanted to talk about with some of Jen's other
books. I'll start with the... Yeah. Well, one of the things I wanted to mention, and I brought this up to you, I think two GRNWs ago. It may have just been one. May have been last GRNW. I don't know. I don't have a concept of time anymore. About 3 years ago, I lived in California, and... I was staying in Irvine with my best friend's cousin, Amber, who is very lovely and reads a lot of the same things that I do, and I always trust her taste. And she was reading we're just going to call it The Lord of the White Hell so I don't have to try and pronounce something.
Oh, yeah. No, feel free. Lord of the White Hell book.
Yep, that series. She was reading those, and she had been telling me, like, oh, yeah, I'm reading some Jin Hale. And I was like, oh, yeah, I love Jin Hale. I haven't read those yet, though. One night, I was sleeping on basically a mattress on her floor, and she usually went to bed at reasonable human hours, and I never do. So I'm, like, reading on my phone, doing whatever, and Amber was apparently still awake, and I hadn't noticed. And I just hear her start to lose her goddamn mind. Like, I thought she was asleep, or at least, you know, well on her way to it, and she just starts, like, flailing, going, what the fuck? What the fuck? What the fuck? And I was like, are you okay? Like, is everything okay up there, Amber? And she was just like, Jin Hale just destroyed my brain. Like, what? This twist. I can usually see twists coming. I didn't see this twist. What the hell? And then she just kept basically having a meltdown. And one, it was adorable. Because I don't think I've ever seen her. She's very collected. I've never seen her that, like, shell-shocked by anything, let alone in fiction. And then that also convinced me that I immediately needed to read Lord of the White Hell. But how did you come up, and I'm not going to spoil the twist. I know what the twist is, but I'm not going to spoil it. How did you come up with that such a brain-breaking twist? Was it something that you knew going into it, or did it sort of... You would have had to, I think, knowing what it is.
I would love to say that I did. Actually, I don't know what twist she's referring to. I probably shouldn't admit that. I do outline my books entirely, so...
How much of that story, because it's what, it's over four books, basically. That series is over four books.
Actually, it's going to be another, I'm working on the next, hopefully it'll only be two more. It's probably going to be three, though. The third installment, and it'll be all done.
Yay! I am pleased. The stuff that you're working on now, like, did you have any inkling that any of that was going to go on when you started the first book?
Yes.
Okay.
I knew it before I started. I come up with my endings first, so I know the big shape of my stories. So I always know the endings of my books, and particularly if it's going to be a series, I have to know where the series ends, and then I can put things in earlier that become keys. Like in the first book, there's a character, Aris Planato, who, if you don't remember him, you probably shouldn't. He has maybe a part of a scene. He just shows up and he duels against Karam, and Karam's like, wow, he's a really dull looking guy. And, you know, that's the notable thing about him is he's really dull looking, but he almost always beats his opponents in like duels because he's so easy to underestimate. And he's one of the main characters in the third windup. And, you know, his point of view has an entirely different thing that's going on in that first story and during that first duel. But it's one of those things where even as I was writing it, I'm like, oh, I can't wait for them to find out about this 10 years from now.
Quite literally.
Oh, it's going to be worth it, you know. I think it helps to have a practical joker like my mom, you know, someone who's clearly told a joke and it's going to, at some point I'm going to realize it and come back to her, but it might be 15 years later.
The long con.
Right. To really plant that in me. So I'm like, I can be like, yeah, boy, when I finally get those final books done, people are going to be like, oh, she knew. So even in the first book, there's just this one passing mention of Elazar's scar on his thigh. You know, it's just like, it's embedded in a description of like how the Caedleonians are all like scarred up messes, and Karam's kind of like, I've got one scar on my thumb, you know, and he's like, you know, you guys are messed up that you're into this, but okay. But the reason that whole little section is in there is to kind of set up that there is something larger going on with the character of Elazar that you don't know about from Karam's point of view. So Karam has his own experience and some ideas about Elazar, which are, you know, to some extent very true, but he isn't aware of a much larger kind of conflict that is going on within Elazar's storyline, and that happens, that follows Champion of the Scarlet Wolf in the second book. And so there's a lot of things that I put in that, you know, might seem like really arbitrary or funny or just, you know, random, like you don't even notice, but I've put them in for a reason.
That's so that in 10 years you can be like, heh.
So that in 10 years, hopefully, one reader. Well, the thing I always think is like, yeah, a lot of readers aren't even going to remember he showed up.
Like, he's well, maybe an interesting you have those character. Really close readers or someone who just went and reread the early stuff to refresh. Right.
And those people will be so excited. Those people will be like, holy shit.
Those are the people that I write it for, because those are the people who are kind of like me who go back, you know, and I'm just always like, oh my God, oh my God. I get so excited about like when I'm seeing other people's like stories or, you know, reading books and stuff, and I'll be like, this is going to come all together in this way and I'm going to be so excited. And then of course, like a third of the time, I'm totally wrong. And like, it just doesn't come together like I wanted it. And I'm like, wait, no, you could have built this story so much better.
See, I'm glad that we have an oral record of the fact that you planned to bring that character back from the beginning. Because what if someone did notice and was like, oh, well, she must have just been like, who can I put in this, you know, this basically the last bit? I'll go back and comb through my...
I'm going to pick this character I described as really dull. That'll be the one. Those things are actually really, really planned in advance. The same thing with the Rifter series. It really required a huge amount of plotting. and seeding like clues and things in advance to have that story come together.
In terms of word count, do you remember how long the Rifter series ended up being? Because I swear to God, someone told me at one point, or at least guesstimated, and I have forgotten, and my brain just keeps inventing figures that can't be real.
I don't actually remember now. I remember that it was in the hundreds of thousands of words. Originally it was written as one book, and it's huge. It's like three very, very large books, or 10 volumes in a serial. And that's it edited down.
Yeah. I think it was NK. I think it was Nicole Kimberling who originally told me the word count, and I was like, head explodes.
She would know. She was the one who had to collate it, because I wrote it in 2000. It took about 5 years to write, and then I took a look at it, and I was like, this is way too big, and so I threw it away. And that was it. And then I just went on writing. And then years later, Nicole and Gavin Grant, who runs Small Beer Press, were kind of planning on how to put together a serial. And they wanted to, you know, see if they could get a manuscript with an author who'd be okay with things going wrong, and, you know, like if it didn't load right or whatever.
Who wanted to be a test hamster, yeah.
Right, but they knew that wouldn't, like, freak out completely. And so, of course, you know, they were like, hey, Jen. And I was like, yeah. And Nicole was like, hey, so that Rifter story you had. And I was like, yeah. And she's like, would you like to sell it? And I'm like, yeah, right? Knowing in the back of my head, I'm like, I think I threw it away, right? And she's like, so great. Why don't you just send it along and Gavin and I will, you know, put it together, make a serial, and we'll edit it. And I'm like, yeah, that'll be no problem at all. Just
I'll find
get
it.
Right back to you really soon on that. And fortunately, I had been in a writer's group, and the people in the writer's group had liked the story so much that they'd kept it. Different people
had
different versions of it.
Wow.
But I had to go around to the writer's group and say, hey, you guys, you remember that Rifter story I wrote a while back? Do any of you happen to have any of the pages from it? Because I just can't find it anywhere. And, you know, my co-writer, Astrid, who we meet up and write together a lot, was just like, started just glaring at me. She's like, you threw it away, didn't you? God damn it.
Interesting too is like, I can never go back to this again, chucks. Can't use this for anything else. Throws it away.
I just delete things. I just do. I'm like, not gonna work, delete. You know, it's particularly funny when Astrid and I are writing together, because, you know, we're sitting across from each other a lot of times in a coffee shop or wherever, and, you know, she's writing and she writes so fast. It's amazing. Like, it's like speed of light. She's just hitting keys and the words are clearly just pouring out, like this beautiful symphony is just pouring out of like dialogue and scenes, and I'm like tapping like one, the, no, a door opened, no, the door exploded. Okay,
this sounds eerily familiar.
Right. And so painfully, like over an hour, I will eventually get, you know, some miserable, meager word count. And then I'll look at it and I'll be like, nah, delete. She'll just be like, did you just delete, like, everything you wrote today? And I'm like, yep, back to the drawing board tomorrow.
It wasn't what I wanted. I got to start over.
At least you're not burdened by, you know, previous scenes that didn't work out.
I have to save this. It's my precious darling. You're like, nah.
Oh, no. I have no problem with that whole kill your darlings thing. My darlings are long gone. I'm like, oh, this is my favorite scene ever. That sucks. Delete.
I can do it better. It doesn't need to be here. In fact, it's my least favorite scene now. I wanted to ask you, because I saw that Wicked Gentleman was published in 07. I'm sure you didn't write it in 07, but it was published 10 years ago. And I was going to ask, how do you think your writing has changed since its publication?
Let's see. I used the word was a lot less.
Don't we all?
Well, it's just one of those that I'm like, I'm conscious of the word was, and I remove it a lot more early on.
Yeah.
It's maybe a little less poetic. I'm probably a little less focused on actual wordcraft. I don't know if that clear. I'm not trying to like build beautiful sentences because I realize that isn't really my strong point anyway. I really try and focus more on just building a really nice plot and creating kind of fascinating, interesting worlds. But those are my strengths, and so I try to play to my strengths more. I don't spend a lot of time, she probably shouldn't admit this, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about myself and my writing so much as I just write. You know, I try not to be too analytical about it or too focused inward so much as I just try and, you know, just write a story. And the, you know, and the craft of it, you know, it's usually on a sentence level where, you know, I'm writing and I'm like, oh, that sentence doesn't make sense. There is no verb. Put a verb in. Good. Done. On to the next thing. And part of that's probably from the fact that I am pretty dyslexic. So writing itself is very difficult for me. And, you know, my brother doesn't write at all. He has dyslexia to a much greater extent than I do, so I've been very fortunate. But it does make it a lot more of a challenge, and so it's much easier instead of focusing on the, you know, the floweriness of words or like building beautiful language, just to focus on a plot and the actions and what I can visualize. Like I can visualize the whole world and how all the characters are moving, and like, you know, I can move it around in my head and then just try to make words describe what I'm able to see.
This might be too personal, but does the dyslexia get in the way of your enjoying reading as well?
It makes reading very, very difficult. I'm what you would call a very slow reader. So like when, you know, people ask me about research and stuff, a lot of times they don't realize that for me, you know, like for someone else, reading one book will be like, they whipped through a book in a day, but I will have to spend like a full week. So yeah, that's just how it is. It's kind of a give and take. You know, I think I'm very fortunate in that I'm able to see things, you know, like mentally picture things in three dimensions a lot better than I can read. So it really helps me that way. But yeah, reading is very, very, very difficult. It's not as hard as it is for my brother. My younger brother, you know, when he reads a book, I know it has been a real effort of love. And like the first time that he was like, I read your book, I was like, oh my God. And then we just hugged. Like,
you never have to learn.
And no one else
ever
there would have understood what it was, like what was going on, like why I was like getting all teary eyed. And he's like looking at me really serious. And we're just like hugging it out big time because he's read my book, Wicked Gentleman, which is like 200 pages. You know, but it was really, really touching that he put in that effort because I know how hard it is.
Have you either of y'all tried audiobooks, or is that just not, does your brain not engage with that? Because I read very fast, and I actually have a harder time processing audiobooks than written text.
I do audiobooks to some extent, but I like being when I am reading, because it takes so much focus. I really, really read every word. So that does help me. Also, it's really hard to find a lot of books that deal with marginalized stories that are on audio, especially nonfiction.
Well, I was actually talking about this with one of my friends last night, and I read very, very quickly, and I glean, like, I wouldn't say I read every word, because that's just not possible at the speed I read at, but I retain information quite well, and I glean a lot of it quite well, and it's actually made me a very lazy student in many respects, because I don't actually have to read the whole book by any means, and I can get it done really quickly. But one of the things that I have to do in order to do that is hyper-focus. But I usually know that if I'm going to read a book, I will read it in a day. So the emotional commitment of spending, you know, 4 hours, depending on the length of the book, 2 to 6 hours with a book in a sitting or two is actually hard. It's not without, you know, it's like, oh, breezily, I read very fast. You know, I can finish 2-3 books a day if I really want to. Yeah, but that's actually exhausting. Right, so anytime there's a book I want to read, I kind of know that I'm going to be sitting with it all day. And I tend to put things off because I'm like, well, I don't have all day to sit down with a book. I have to go do this and I have to edit and I have to do whatever. And I already read for a living anyway. So it's like, I don't know. I'm generally fatigued with it.
Down with reading, damn it.
No more
Let's
reading.
Never read.
No more reading on no this podcast. Reading. We're only ever going to play Overwatch. That's the only thing that will ever happen.
Yep. This is now a video games podcast. Sorry, everyone.
It's the last episode of about being It's the last episode of it being about queer romance. I'm now spending a lot more time because I through talking to Tracy Timmons Gray, who is visually impaired, you know, thinking more about, and I'm half deaf as well, so I think about the sort of audio side of it and how I really, one of the things that frustrates me about producing THR is that I don't have the time to go back and write out transcripts, and I don't want to have to ask someone to do that voluntarily and not pay them because it's hard work.
Accessibility is incredibly important, and being able to change fonts is actually quite useful. Unfortunately, Comic Sans is one of the easiest fonts to read if you have dyslexia. So sometimes when people look over, they're like, so, reading in Comic Sans, I see. And you're like, shut up, leave me alone.
It serves a purpose.
No, I don't even explain. I'm like, yeah, I think it's pretty good looking. I like it. You know,
it's like, my favorite font.
I'm like, whatever.
Jin, thank you so much for the great discussion and for being on the show. This has been a lovely conversation, only mildly marred by Skype's attempt to destroy this podcast from the inside out, and only a little at the end. So Jin's book, The Long Past, comes out on October 3rd.
Yes.
Yes. Let's say yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Comes out on October 3rd, and you should check it out. And in the meantime, if you would like to continue the conversation with us on Twitter, I am at Austin Chanted.
I am at Amanda H. Jean.
And I'm at Jin Hale.
At Jin Hale.
Two N's.
Two double N. Jin double N.
Oh, yeah. G-I-N-N-H-A-L-E.
We got this covered from every single angle that there is.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Thank you, Jin.
You were a wonderful guest. Yeah.
Bye. Bye.
This episode of The Hopeless Romantic was produced by Daria DeFora and Amanda Jean, with art by Keezy Young and music by Carly Ann Warden. If you want to continue the conversation, follow us on Twitter at TheHRPodcast, follow us on Facebook, check out our Patreon, and please rate and review on iTunes if you enjoyed.